It's been almost 4 weeks since the Illinois General Assembly last met. Like many other groups, lawmakers are staying home to prevent the spread of COVID-19. We'll talk to Illinois Senate President Don Harmon about what they might eventually do to address the crisis.
Anyone who tells you they know how this is going to work out, I think is thinking wishfully.
Plus, as Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order continues until the end of April, we'll unpack what it means to be an essential business and talk about some of the challenges essential workers are facing. And with everything from schools to music venues closed right now because of coronavirus, we'll talk to musicians about going virtual to stay connected. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Another day, another 937 newly confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Illinois. There have now also been 99 deaths here. Governor J.B. Pritzker said, as of Tuesday afternoon, Illinois still has enough hospital beds and ventilators to address the crisis.
But from all the modeling that we've seen, our greatest risk of hitting capacity isn't right now, but weeks from now. The virus's spread is growing. So are its risks. We must not let up now.
Because of that, Pritzker is extending his stay-at-home order through April 30th, closing schools, canceling sporting events, and blocking dine-in at restaurants.
If we can end these orders earlier, I'll be the first one to tell you when we can start to make strides toward normalcy again. But that time is not today, and it's not April 7th. Illinois has one of the strongest public health systems in the nation, but even so, we aren't immune to this virus's ability to push our existing capacity beyond its limits. We need to maintain our course and keep working to flatten the curve.
Meanwhile, it's been almost 4 weeks since the Illinois General Assembly last met. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Don Harmon, president of the Illinois Senate. We communicated by FaceTime from his district office in Oak Park. It was just before the governor announced he'd be extending his stay-at-home order, but anticipating that, I asked what would happen if lawmakers couldn't meet before the scheduled end of session in May, or even the end of the budget year in June.
I recognize that there is work that only the General Assembly can do, and so we are working as a team to figure out how it is we would live up to our responsibilities. We are certainly one of the critical businesses that would be allowed to work, notwithstanding the stay-at-home order, but I'm very cautious about calling people back into session and putting them and our staff's health in jeopardy unnecessarily. So we're evaluating the tools that we have to determine what we would have to do, how we could do it, what alternatives to the conventional ways of doing business might be available to us. And we haven't reached any firm conclusion yet, but I expect we'll be able to live up to our basic obligations in a way that minimizes the threat to anyone's well-being.
Is there anything that's been ruled out? I mean, you've heard speculation about different state legislatures possibly meeting remotely. Is that seems like something that would even be allowable under the Illinois Constitution?
I think there are impediments to doing that without express legal authorization, but we're evaluating all those sticking points to see if I think we certainly could meet, enact a law, and allow us to meet in a virtual space. But we're still trying to figure out how we would do that and if it's worth doing.
And you've also heard speculation about, you know, perhaps negotiating behind closed doors and then, you know, holding the roll call open. Usually in Illinois, it's not like if people are used to watching C-SPAN. You see on Congress, roll calls can go on forever and ever. It's usually pretty short in Illinois, as you know. But I mean, there's no rule that says it has to be that way.
That's right. And obviously, if we are going to have a roll call vote in person, we would want to do it responsibly so that social distancing was respected and we didn't have a floor full of members and staff at one time. I expect there will be all sorts of innovation considered in order to live up to our obligations to govern.
Well, you mentioned a few moments ago some of the things that only the General Assembly can do. And obviously, the big one there is the state budget. As you probably know, the legislature's independent budget analysts who staff the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability recently issued a report with a section titled Uncertainty of a COVID-19 Recession. And it reads in part, attempting to value the impact of COVID-19 on state revenues is virtually impossible. And then it suggests that this could be even worse than the Great Recession and possibly a decline of 20% in revenue. That would be worth $8 billion, maybe spread over a few fiscal years. I wonder, right now, Senate President Harmon, what is the best estimate you have for what this crisis is doing to the state's revenues?
I don't know, and I don't know if anyone knows with certainty. This is fundamentally different from a recession like the one we saw in 2008. It is based on external factors, not an internal shortcoming in the economy. But that said, I don't think anyone knows what happens when you flip the switch back into the on position. How quickly does the economy recover? What areas recover more quickly than others? So anyone who tells you they know how this is going to work out, I think is thinking wishfully. That said, there is no doubt there will be a disruption into our revenues and also into our expenditures. What new demands will there be on state resources because of the pandemic? We're also trying to unpack what the federal action means. The CARES package coming out of Congress has all sorts of support and relief for different elements of our economic system. So we're trying to figure out how that fits into the shortcomings we might experience because of the pandemic.
And I've heard anecdotally that all kinds of healthcare providers, these are agencies that provide meals to the elderly or some of the other ones, all these groups that take care of people on behalf of the state, that their costs are going up while their revenue is going down because they're not able to do the services that they can get reimbursed for from the federal government, maybe. Do you have a sense of that in terms of percentages on what that will cost the state?
I don't at this point. I know that is being felt most acutely by the hospitals, which are the epicenter of this response. And it is obviously timed with a dramatic reduction in the revenue generating activity typically found at a hospital. Any sort of surgery that can be delayed is being delayed. Senator Durbin in Washington has referred to the federal bill as a Marshall Plan for hospitals. There's significant resources available. We just don't know yet how that's going to be distributed and filtered down to our hospitals to try to plug in those profound gaps they're experiencing.
And does Illinois have a plan, or do you have any thoughts about what Illinois can do to backstop those agencies as they're struggling?
This is an emerging situation, and I wish I could tell you that we had a clear plan, but we're still in the middle of it. And we are supporting the governor, who I think is doing a remarkable job of leading in an uncertain time. And at this point, the legislative response is understandably delayed until things settle down a bit. But I look forward to working with my colleagues in the legislature and with the governor to make sure we use all the tools at our disposal to bring Illinois back once the dust settles.
What does the work of legislating look like now? I mean, people who have to go to work at grocery stores and who drive delivery trucks are going to their job sites still. Many of us who are fortunate enough to be able to work from home are doing that. Are you still working from home as the Senate president, and what does that look like?
I am working from home, but I'm also lucky to have a district office very close to my house, which is almost always more empty than my house. I'm not running an electronic high school out of my district office like I am at the dining room table. So I am lucky. Most of my time is spent communicating with others, with members of the caucus, with the governor and his team, and with constituents who are looking for answers. And even if I don't have the answers right now, I'm trying to inventory the questions so that we can be responsive. And we're trying to be a conduit of responsible information that our constituents need to know.
What you mentioned, you know, you're keeping track of the questions. And I think a question you hear a lot in Springfield, at least among people who follow state government closely, is beyond the budget, what are the other essential pieces of legislation this spring? And how is that going to be decided? What can you say about that? Are there any other must-dos? I mean, we're coming into this session, we were hearing about clean energy jobs and changing the gambling laws to allow a more favorable environment for the Chicago casino to get up and running. I mean, are there things that are still on a must-do post-it somewhere on your desk?
Well, I don't think it's my list or anyone else's list. It in the end will be a list that we all agree is essential to do now. And so I'm in touch with the other legislative leaders and with the governor. There is no list at this point. I would say immediately it is things relating to the state budget and things relating to a response to the pandemic for the continuity of government. So we should pass a budget. The hospital assessment program is even more important now, given all the work that hospitals are doing. And it is, in the end, a critical piece of our state budget. How do we fund hospitals? How do we maximize federal revenue that is available to the state of Illinois? There are things like amending the Open Meetings Act to allow state agencies and local governments to continue to meet in virtual session. The governor's executive order allowed that, but I think making sure that it is clear in statute that that sort of practice is permitted for the duration of this pandemic and for the next makes a lot of sense.
As you are traveling to your district office and presumably going out and doing the grocery shopping and other essential buying that many of us are still doing, do you get a sense for how this stay-at-home order has affected the Illinois economy?
You know, it is without a doubt impacting us in ways we cannot fully understand today. I stopped for gas at the service station my family's been going to for more than 50 years, and they're running a pretty thin crew, but they're staying open because they're an essential business, and I admire them for sticking it out. But we're going to have to figure out, you know, what government resources are available to backstop them. I 2 days ago, I went for pet food for the dog, and the store was pretty empty, but they were continuing to be there for all the pet owners in the area that want to feed their dogs and cats. I just don't think we understand the breadth or the depth of this quite yet. But we're going to have to be there when we come out of this to make sure that these businesses that are such an important part of our community survive.
I mean, are you talking about some sort of economic stimulus? And if so, is Illinois even in any sort of position to be able to provide that?
You know, for better or worse, we passed the largest capital infrastructure bill in our state's history last year, and we are just in the process of implementing it. Now, obviously, there are direct interactions with the pandemic. Much of the vertical construction, the non-transportation projects depend upon revenue from casinos, and casinos aren't operating right now. But these things go hand in hand, and we're going to have to try to use that government spending as a kickstarter to the economy. We are better positioned than most states by virtue of having done most of the work already. That doesn't mean we aren't going to have to patch some holes here and make sure that we're ready to go 100% as soon as we're allowed to and as soon as the economy can digest it.
You know, we're all looking forward to that time when the economy starts coming back and the stay-at-home order gets lifted. But health experts are saying that even after we get through this first wave of COVID-19 infections, there may be others in the future, really until there's a vaccine or enough people have built up immunities. Do you have a sense of what lawmakers can do, particularly to support the medical community at this time?
Well, I certainly wish we would have been preparing for this before the first wave, but I hope that there is an emerging national awareness of the need to be fully prepared before there is either a resurgence of COVID-19 or another similar episode in the future. I hope we are never caught so far back on our heels ever again.
The last thing I want to ask you about, and this does fit into the state revenue picture, is obviously the big one of the big financial question marks hanging over this year's or the coming year's budget is the graduated income tax, which is going to be on the ballot for voters this fall. They're going to be deciding whether the state should end its constitutional requirement to have a flat tax and instead allow for the implementation of legislation that's already been passed that would impose different rates, higher rates on people who are wealthier, make more than $250,000 a year, and lower rates on people below that income threshold. How does this climate bode for the passage of the graduated income tax, which you have been a longtime supporter of?
You know, I have not given much thought to the politics of anything in the wake of the pandemic. But just in response to that question, I can almost guarantee you that families making more than $250,000 are doing a heck of a lot better today than families making less than that. Folks lucky enough to be earning that kind of money are certainly less likely to have lost their jobs because of the pandemic. This is really hitting those people that the fair tax would most benefit. I suspect we'll be talking about that going into the fall, that this is a chance to bring tax relief to the same people who have been knocked out of a job or seen their hours dramatically reduced, or who have been pushed to work in really challenging situations at a grocery store register or driving a truck to fulfill our communal responsibilities. So again, I haven't given it much thought, but I, on first glance, don't think it diminishes the chances that the fair tax would pass. If anything, it heightens the difference between being well off and hanging on by a string.
Don Harmon is the president of the Illinois Senate. He joined us from his district office in Oak Park. President Harmon, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. We would love it if you would send us your quarantine projects. I actually spoke with President Harmon about that. Didn't have time for this show, but tweet it to us at 21STShow and stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. You're tuned in to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to unfold, Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order, as we said earlier, has been extended through April 30th. In the past few weeks, many of us have had to make changes to our daily routines, whether it's limiting all non-essential trips out of the house, adjusting to working from home, or practicing social distancing. But if you look out your window today, you might see Amazon or UPS delivery trucks dropping off packages. Or if you need to pick up something at your local hardware store, you likely can still do so. That's because Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order lists dozens of business categories that are considered essential, everything from the postal service to banks to food production. These are stores and companies that have been encouraged to remain open, whereas other non-essential businesses were told to close or send employees to work from home. Yesterday, producer Libby Foster caught up with an Illinois postal worker while she was on her route. Many essential workers have been faced with the difficult decision to either stay home and risk losing pay or go into work, where many say they're not getting adequate safety protection.
Work's been kind of hard because, you know, people call off from work, and just because of the simple fact they don't want to get sick even though they don't have the flu. So it's been kind of tough, because everything's been heavy, because people are home ordering more stuff. So I enjoy, you know, working and helping out others, even though it's everything going on around me. But if, like, we're putting our own self in risk and getting sick, but we still, you know, come to work and put forth the effort to bring out the outgoing mail and bring packages out and mail and things like that.
For more on all of this, I'm joined on the line now by Alexia Elijalde Ruiz. She's been covering this for the Chicago Tribune. Alexia, thank you for being with us again. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
And Stephanie Furtado is also with us. She's a lecturer in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. Stephanie, welcome back to the 21st. Glad to have you as well.
Glad to be here.
So, Alexia, I want to start with you. I think the term essential workers is kind of confusing, and there can be obvious ones like healthcare workers, but a lot of different groups of people are still having to go out to work. Can you help us figure out this category? What are some of the essential businesses listed in Governor Pritzker's stay-at-home order?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, there are dozens, and it encompasses a wide range of industries. So obviously healthcare, obviously, you know, the grocery store workers you're seeing out there, but also accountants are considered essential. Laundromats, dry cleaners are considered essential. Companies that make supplies to work for, to help you work from home are considered essential. Media and then also, you know, lawyers and real estate services, but also companies that supply essential businesses. So it kind of, you know, it works its way up to a broader category than you might initially think.
And is it just Governor Pritzker who decides who is considered essentials? Do businesses have some say in this?
So the businesses, you know, look at the order and determine themselves whether or not they believe that they are essential. And then they let their employees know. And then often, you know, they are providing a letter to employees saying that they're essential just in case they get stopped along the way to see why they're out and about. So there's not like you don't get an official essential designation. There's no one policing it, but there are ways to report that you, if you believe that you are working for a company that should not have designated itself essential.
What happens if a company decides to flout the order? Is there any sort of penalty? Are there people policing this?
So the city of Chicago has said that residents can call 311 to report an essential business or a business that is operating that should not be considered essential. And I believe that there are fines of I think it's $1,000. I can like check that. Either $1,000 or $10,000. A big difference. $10,000. If the city investigates and finds that they have violated that order. At the state level, there doesn't seem to be some official, you know, way to file a complaint. But Governor Pritzker the other day during one of his press conferences, you know, did say that if you feel like you're, you know, that you're in a situation that seems unsafe, whether it's an essential business or one that shouldn't be operating, you know, to contact the health department.
Stephanie, I want to ask you, so I think, like we said earlier, it's understandable amid a global pandemic that healthcare workers would be essential, but I don't think a lot of people before this crisis gave thought to the idea that grocery store clerks could be considered essential. And I wonder, do different interpretations of what is an essential business? I think there was a story out of Colorado, maybe one of our producers mentioned that the Hobby Lobby there might have had a disagreement with government as to whether they were essential. Stephanie, if you have these disputes between employers and employees, is this something we're seeing?
Yeah, definitely. And Hobby Lobby has sort of gotten a lot of national attention in that way. Both in Wisconsin and in Indiana, the police actually had to come in and shut down two different Hobby Lobby stores. They had closed, but then they had reopened. And according to the Department of Homeland Security and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, between 49 to 62 million workers in the United States are considered essential in all of these different categories. So in the Chicagoland area, that's roughly a third of all the workers in the metro area. And you're right, there's a lot of, work that we immediately think of as essential, right? Healthcare workers, firemen and police, but there's a lot of other workers that have to go to work in order to, you know, make sure we all have food on our tables, right? Make sure that we get the supplies that we need to live. And sometimes those categories are difficult to determine.
Yeah, supplies we need to live, like, I don't know, sparkles and yarn, I guess, in the Hobby Lobby case. What if an employee feels like they're concerned about working, their employer wants them to work, Are there recourses? Are there protections for employees who don't show up to work because of the concerns about the virus?
Well, and that's the problem, right, is a lot of these workers are already low-wage workers. The average grocery store worker in the United States makes less than $11 an hour. A lot of these workers don't have paid sick leave. 1.4 million workers in Illinois don't have paid sick leave. So, there have been expansions because of COVID-19 to provide more paid sick leave for workers. But a lot of workers have to face, really tough decisions. If they don't get to go to work, are they going to get paid, right? And especially if they've not been laid off by their company, it's tricky then to try to get unemployment. So are they going to go out and risk their health or are they going to get a paycheck? And a lot of the workers that, for a long time have been some of the lowest paid workers, right, in our society, we're finding out through this crisis how essential they really are.
And not only risking their own health, but risking the health of the community, especially if you think of somebody like a delivery driver. Do the businesses that employ workers like this, do they have a responsibility to the public, do you think, to keep people at home?
I do. I think every employer should be looking very carefully at how to minimize contact between employees and between employees and the public. And, you've seen some of this. You go to grocery stores and you see now that there's plastic face guards. We went grocery shopping the other day and we saw that they had installed at our grocery store guards between the cashier and the people that are checking out. So I do think employers are trying to keep their employees safe, but a lot of the PPE is going to healthcare providers as it should. But what we've seen is that a lot of these frontline workers in different industries are getting sick. So there's four postal workers in the Chicago area who have COVID. There's a CTA bus driver and a CTA transit worker. And in New York, there are 8 MTA transit workers have already died. There's 582 that are sick and 3,000 more that are under quarantine. So in a very real way, these workers who are providing these essential work, often at very low wages, are taking their lives into their hand to go to work every day.
Well, earlier this week, several workers at Amazon and Instacart walked off the job. The walkout came after workers in at least 11 Amazon locations nationwide have tested positive for COVID-19. These demonstrations also come at a time when both companies are hiring hundreds of thousands of new workers to handle the surge in delivery orders. Here's Chris Smalls speaking with CNBC on Monday. He was a management assistant at an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, but he says he was fired earlier this week following the walkout.
It's been scary. It's been real scary. Unfortunately, we have people that were out there today with me that haven't been in that building the entire month. They're afraid for their lives. They're afraid for their family lives. And that was the reason of the whole entire movement. Just me being the voice and sticking up for those who don't have a voice. I felt it was the right thing to do. Unfortunately, it cost me my job, but I don't want to work for a company that doesn't take care of their people. And the Amazon has dropped the ball on that.
That's audio is again from CNBC. Alexia, do we know if the Amazon and Instacart walkouts, did those stretch into Illinois as well?
Instacart did. So that's a really loosely organized group of people. They're all gig workers, for the most part, who are out there, selecting people's groceries and then driving them to their homes. The lead organizer was in California. There definitely were people in the Chicago area and Illinois who were participating. It's so hard to know how many. But yeah, their big concerns were just that they're not getting the proper equipment to keep themselves safe. They're just asking for, the company to provide hand sanitizer and disinfectant to spray down their phones. They also want, they had some tipping requests. They just feel like given the circumstances and that they're putting themselves out there, that they should be treated better.
And Alexia, what have we heard from other big companies here in Illinois, in particular about how they're handling the stay-at-home order? I guess some chains are offering increased pay.
Yeah, so some chains, I mean, so a lot of the food production companies are offering bonuses, or they're increasing pay by $2 an hour, for example, as they try to, you know, motivate people to keep going to work, because a lot of people are afraid and just not coming in. They're also trying to hire thousands more people to meet kind of rising consumer demand for a lot of food. So you're seeing that from a lot of the food producers. You're seeing that also from some of the grocery stores, that they're raising wages by about $2 an hour, seems to be kind of the what's been consistent. So the question is, you know, is that worth it to people who might, you know, really be nervous about coming in and being so exposed to the public?
And what about sick time benefits? Have we seen any changes there?
So a lot of companies are offering COVID-specific sick time benefits. You know, they're saying, like, if you're diagnosed with COVID, you can get 2 weeks of paid sick time. But that's obviously tough, you know, to be officially diagnosed when there are so few tests around. So some of them, you know, they're things are changing so frequently. But, you know, some of them are just saying if you have symptoms. Chicago, obviously, and some Cook County suburbs has a law that requires employers to offer at least about five paid sick days a year. And then there's the new federal emergency paid sick time, which doesn't require an official positive test, but rather just, you know, symptoms, that applies to employers with under 500 workers. So there's paid sick time out there, but I'm sure there are definitely employers out there that are not necessarily offering it, which is or at least not paid. You know, they're just saying that people won't get dinged for attendance if they don't come in. But that does put workers who are at those companies that don't have paid sick time in a very precarious situation about whether to decide to forego the paycheck or stay home with their symptoms.
Stephanie, I want to ask you, and we're coming to the end of our conversation here, just a few minutes left, but this situation is putting more pressure on the workers that remain. More people are choosing to stay at home, and companies like Amazon or the Postal Service, then they have to accommodate more online ordering. And as we heard, this increased pressure and concerns over safety have led to walkouts from Amazon and Instacart employees. Do you think we could be seeing more of that sort of thing as this situation continues to unfold?
I do. And I think, you know, you've seen a lot of unions making demands for their workers to receive hazard pay. You know, the University of Illinois, where I work, the campus labor coalition just put out a statement that the workers that are still having to come to campus to do essential services, that they should be receiving hazard pay. And so you see this, that there's increasing demands that workers should be given consideration for, you know, like that interview that we heard at the beginning of the segment, the postal worker, as more people aren't coming and as more people are bringing deliveries into their home in order to keep their social distancing, that means there's more pressure on postal workers, right, who are carrying heavier loads. And I do think that workers, both within unions and non-unionized workers, are going to continue to stand up and say, hey, you know, we deserve to be considered and treated fairly during this crisis.
And the last thing I want to ask you about, Stephanie, is we've been talking about big businesses here for the most part. And again, we've only got about a minute now, but there are a lot of small businesses in a really difficult position right now. Can you talk about some of the challenges in terms of employees that would be unique to working in a small business as opposed to one of these major corporations?
Right. And in some ways, you know, the federal law actually only applies to businesses under 500, right? And so that does provide some safety net for those workers in those businesses if they cannot go to work. But yeah, small businesses, you know, local restaurants, local food service providers, things like that, you know, this is going to be a really tough time for them. To try to navigate this, but also then the aftermath of when this ends, how many of them are going to make it through is something that we haven't seen yet.
Stephanie Furtado is a lecturer in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We also spoke with Alexia Elhelde Ruiz, who's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Stephanie, Alexia, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Like a lot of people practicing social distancing, some of us are working on quarantine projects. If we are fortunate enough to not be in the position of having to go into work, and if we have some free time, maybe picking up an instrument we haven't played in a number of years, cracking that book that's been collecting dust on the shelf. We are collecting your stories about it. We want to see your pictures or send us a voice memo about what you're working on. You can email that to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also tweet us at 21stshow. Use the hashtag StayAtHomeIL. We'll feature your work on our website. More to come. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. With everything from schools to music venues closed now because of the coronavirus, musicians and artists are doing what all of us have to do to stay connected, going virtual. And of course, that includes choirs and singing groups. Since they can't get together in person, many have been calling each other on apps like Zoom to sing and then splicing the various parts together to create a virtual chorus, like this one from West Aurora High School. This is the West Aurora High School Madrigal Singers from Aurora, Illinois, singing The Road Home by Stephen Paulus, all recorded separately and remotely from students' homes and then edited together into a virtual chorus. Brian Smith is one of the choir directors at West Aurora High School, and he also teaches digital music production there. Seems like a particularly useful skill these days. And put together that virtual chorus you just heard. Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Also joining us are members of the West Aurora Madrigal Choir, all seniors in high school. Thank you all for joining us as well. So, Brian, I understand you put together that video of the West Aurora Madrigal Choir, all singing their separate parts. How does that process work? How long does it take to do something like that?
Yeah, so we found out that we were returning to school a couple of weeks ago on a Friday, actually after school, after spending a good chunk of the day hearing about how we weren't, we were probably going to need to change or reschedule or possibly cancel a few upcoming concerts. So the students decided that night that they wanted to put together one of these virtual ensembles. And so the next day, Saturday, I gave them new music for a piece that they had not worked on together. We gave them the music on Saturday, and they had until Monday afternoon to learn their parts, refine their parts, collaborate with each other and talk to each other to agree on any musical details they needed to, and then individually record their parts and send them to me. So I received Monday night, I received 22 individual videos, and then I was able to edit the audio and the video together to make the final product. And the editing for 22 separate tracks took about 20 hours of editing over a period of a couple of days. And certainly there are some people who probably could do it much faster than that. But with our first try, it's about how long it took us.
Wow. That is an impressive effort there. Yeah. I think a lot of us are learning all new digital skills these days. A few of the students are with us. What was it like singing your part alone virtually?
Hi. My name's Ellie. It was really interesting singing it alone, of course, because usually we sing in a group, and just having to focus and make sure that my part individually fit in with all of my other fellow members of the group, making sure that we all worked together while also working individually was difficult. But as you can see, the end result was really beautiful, and it was just really cool being a part of it and seeing the response from not only our community, but like places from like Singapore and South Africa and Australia, like see our video and just feel so moved. It was really cool.
So thank you for that, Ellie. I wonder if another student can talk a little bit about their experience of the process of this. I mean, are you using a metronome? Do you have, a keyboard version of the track that you're listening to? How do you stay on pitch?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Sophie. And kind of talking about like how we did it just by ourselves. So there was actually a video recording that Mr. Smith put out of him conducting it. So as we sang it, like we'd start with our pitch and then he would conduct us through the song, which at first was like difficult. And I think all of us agree that from the beginning, the video was really hard to make just being by ourselves. But as we worked through it, we're all, I think in general, really happy that we finished it all because it was really, really powerful. But that the video of him conducting was really what got us through it all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. You all haven't been able to sing together in person since classes have been postponed. I wonder, what do you miss about singing together in the choir?
So I'm Micah. I'm a senior at West. We're all seniors. So the thing I miss the most about singing at West, like in class in choir, is just having everyone around you and being able to talk and communicate your feel like right then and there. And you don't have to like text or you don't have to call and you can see them face to face. And it's just the same with, you know, pretty much everything else. You know, you miss hanging out with your buddies and making jokes and fooling around and then all having a good time and then also learning and singing in a big choir. It's all really different when you're singing by yourself in your room and then you send the recording off to your choir director, but it's still a great time.
Yeah. And this is your senior year. You're all seniors, as you said. And there's this terrible, abrupt ending to this year. Right as of now, the school is closed at least through the end of April. There may be a few school days in May. What is that like, having this end of your high school career this way?
I think it's kind of sad that we don't get to have the extra time with our friends that we may have had since elementary school, because we might be moving away for college. Some people are moving across country, some are going out of country, and some are even staying here in Aurora. But this last period of the few months that we have is all that we have left with some people, and we'd like to, you know, spend a little bit more time with them. And sadly, due to this quarantine, we might not be able to have as much time as we wanted to.
And Brian, I want to end with you. How are you, you know, we heard about the video you put out to sort of coach the students through this piece. How else are you teaching music virtually? And do you plan to make more of these videos?
It's challenging, and it's something that I think everyone everywhere right now is sort of struggling with, is that, what we do in music classes in particular is, it's so inherently collaborative, and it's, making music together is such a human thing. And so we talk about, you see these videos come out, and it's awesome seeing, you know, videos are popping up like the virtual choir video we put together, all over the country and all over the world with people coming together and collaborating on these things. And that's really neat. And it's a really cool way to sort of put something positive out there that people can use as for entertainment right now. I don't think any of us who have participated in one, like there's no pretending it is at all in any way sort of a substitute for, you know, what it is that we actually do. And so will we make another one? Probably at some point. But the challenge for us is moving forward. How can we keep students engaged with music? And also, most importantly, especially as you mentioned here at the end of the year, the community that is built within these classes is just so huge. And so, you know, finding ways, the most important thing as we navigate all of this is, of course, keeping the music going, but also finding ways that we can keep, keep building that collaboration and keep building that sense of family, even as we're separated right now.
That was choir director Brian Smith from West Aurora High School in Aurora, Illinois, and students Ellie Ketley, Sophie Evans, and Micah Hett. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we go from a high school choir that performs on Zoom and joined us by Zoom, incidentally. We go from them to a Central Illinois honky-tonk. The Rose Bowl Tavern in Urbana has been a local spot for live music and maybe a Lone Star beer since the 1940s. You can hear everything from Brazilian music to indie acts and, of course, singers like Dale Watson.
Feeling haggard, I kick those swinging doors. Feeling haggard, I'm a brand of man for sure.
Country singer-songwriter Dale Watson. He was slated to play at the Rose Bowl in Urbana, but like all of their live shows, it was put on hold and money was refunded. Even though patrons can't come to the Rose Bowl for live music, the Rose Bowl is going to them, in a way. To tell us more about how the Honky Tonk is adapting, we're joined by now co-owner Charlie Harris. He's also a musician who plays in the band Bones Jugs, among other projects. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Charlie, I hear that you've turned your bar into a sort of TV studio for live music.
Yes, it's been quite the journey. So as soon as the shutdown, well, even before the shutdown, just as soon as things got noticeably real, how quickly this was transmitting, we canceled a show and closed down on Sunday, I believe it was the 15th. And that night we knew, and then the next morning it was, or the next afternoon, Monday, it was known that things were shut down for good. I think it was technically 9 p.m. on that Monday. But that day we just, myself and Martin Stromberg, my partner, we just realized, okay, we had to figure something out. So we got together with a friend that does a lot of tech stuff with the university and has collaborated with us. We figured out what kind of camera we could afford and wanted. And actually a lot of the webcams were already, there was like no availability. So that was a process in and of itself.
Yeah, so so last week I understand you had a Soul on Sunday performance live streamed on Facebook, and I want to play a little clip. One of the Soul Sunday performers sang this adaptation of the Jackson 5's I'll Be There.
You and I must make a pact. We must fight Corona back. Places you love, don't go there.
Don't go there.
So, that's great. I understand you've also opened up a sort of a bodega, right? You can't have people coming in, buying drinks, eating food, but you have local coffee, milk bones for dogs. Why did you decide to do that?
Oh, man. So, I mean, we were primarily two things, a music venue and a watering hole or a dive bar or whatever. And we have all the coolers, the beer was stocked, and we wanted to keep our employees hired if it made sense and if we could do it safely. And so we just decided, okay, well, we'll take the window out of our storm door, and we'll run like a walk-up sort of kiosk bodega where people can come and get their beer and other beverages. And since then it's sort of developed, and we've realized like, well, with this opportunity to offer a walk-up safe place to buy stuff, we are carrying you know, like candy and chips and soda, sure. And we have whole bean coffee. Yeah.
So we're running out of time, but I just want to ask real briefly, maybe 15, 20 seconds. What feedback have you gotten from your regular fans and patrons? What are you hearing from people in the community?
I mean, I think people are appreciative to have a place where they can grab some of these goods from the bodega. The live streams have just been wonderful because we get to share. We get to still sort of bring people together as much as they can be in the current climate. And I think people need music and need connection and entertainment. I guess, yeah, entertainment. Yeah. But mostly I think it's being with people while they create. And
well, if you want to be with people while they create, enjoy that connection, you can find the Rose Bowl Tavern on Facebook. And that is all the time we have for the 21st today. We are working on a story for tomorrow on quarantine projects. We want to hear about your projects. Send us a picture or voice memo about what you're working on to talk@21stshow.org. Our show is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.